Lately, a whole bunch of monarch butterflies have been fluttering around the parks and gardens. They're passing through our area right now on their annual migration to Mexico. There's a lot of excitement around that for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's just cool, but also every monarch butterfly feels like a victory because scientists and conservationists have been concerned about declining numbers of monarchs for a while. When it comes to this butterfly population, the news, by and large, has not been good lately. But according to today's guests, the monarch migration taking place right now is the most promising we've seen in years. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to talk with Orly Chip Taylor, the director of Monarch Watch, based in Kansas. Hi, Chip.
Hi, Gina. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So what did you see this weekend that was so exciting?
Well, my crew was out at the Baker Wetlands at their Discovery Center. I happened to be coming back from Cleveland, so I missed the event. But they had a great event, and we predicted that this was going to be a wonderful event. We had well over 500 people out there collecting and tagging monarch butterflies, and they tagged a total of 937 butterflies in about a 4.5-hour period, which is about the third highest number that we have been able to tag in the 20 years that we've had this event. So it was a terrific day. The weather was beautiful. The butterflies were plentiful. The kids were abundant. The nets were swinging, and everybody had a good time.
So when I described the monarch migration and why there are so many butterflies here right now, it was a kind of simple version of the story. Can you tell a slightly more expansive version of what so many butterflies are doing here now?
Well, this is the peak of the migration. Generally, the migration was actually a little bit earlier than this, but it's been so warm that they've stayed back into Iowa or even further north. We're getting reports that there's still a lot of butterflies north of here. Generally, the migration starts when the sun reaches a certain point on the horizon, and then they begin moving.
So they're not using calendars.
But they're probably using celestial information. And then, of course, to navigate, they're probably using the Earth's magnetic field. And using the celestial information they're probably using probably has to be associated with ultraviolet light and how the ultraviolet light changes in the sky as the angle of the sun changes in the fall conditions.
First of all, these butterflies are just gorgeous. And second of all, there is something so just awe-inspiring about the way that they are using all this information that humans in our modern world are often not tuned into to do this hugely coordinated thing. Tons of creatures just flying with an unspoken.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, people always ask me, say, well, how do the butterflies know what to do? And they don't know anything, right? The butterflies do not know. They don't have a thinking process that we do where they're evaluating information. Rather, what they're doing is responding to physical changes. They're responding to changes in the environment. And they're responding in a very codified way that has been selected for over the millennia. And so their response is to the changing physical conditions in the fall. Leads them to start this migration about a month before first frost. And they're following the migration at a time when most of the fall flowers are in bloom. So they're maximizing their opportunity to get nectar as they continue to move south. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about all of these butterflies is that they're non-reproductive. That is to say that they're not laying eggs as they're moving. They're in a non-reproductive condition, and they need to be in that condition because being reproductive consumes a lot of energy. And what these butterflies are doing is conserving a lot of energy, and they're building up their fat stores by feeding on flowers so that they can get through the winter, kind of like bears do. In other words, they put on a little bit of fat, and they live off that fat during the winter.
So for people who don't know what's at stake with monarchs right now, can you give us a synopsis of the problem?
Well, monarch populations have been going down for the last 15 years, and there's been quite a bit of concern about this. It really peaked in 2013 when the overwintering population was at an all-time low of only 0.67 hectares. It was just a really minuscule population. Everybody became quite alarmed, and we began examining everything that was associated with this population to determine what it was that actually was responsible for the decline. And it's fairly clear that it's changes in agriculture, it's changes in land use, it's the increase in development, it's the renewable fuel standard. It's a lot of things that have really changed across the country and changed in the habitats that this butterfly uses. So the problem has been mostly a loss of habitat. There have probably been some other factors involved as well. But the net result has been that the population has gone down. And so now the question is, how do we address this? If we want to keep this migration going, what do we have to do about it? And I've been concerned about this for a long time. Starting in 2005, we started a program called the Monarch Way Station Program, trying to get citizens to create habitats for monarch butterflies. We now have another program called the Bring Back the Monarchs program, which is a larger habitat program designed to bring back habitats for monarch butterflies.
But you started this program in the early 2000s, but you actually got started with a smaller project in 1992?
1992, we started tagging monarch butterflies. I was just coming off my research with African bees, the so-called killer bees, and I was looking for another project. And we started something with tagging monarch butterflies. This grew into Monarch Watch, which is the organization that we have now that supports all of these activities.
But you didn't know when you were doing that you were going to learn things that made counting monarch butterflies really a crucial activity.
No, we didn't. I was looking for something new to attack, and from a research standpoint, and it turned out that we started something that was, yes, it was research, but it was really educational, and it was involving the public, and it took me on an entirely different track than I had intended to go.
You know, I mean, I know that this weekend had promising news, but what you've been seeing more generally over the years, as you've kind of alluded to, has not been that encouraging. Overall.
No, you know, what we have to do is deal with the habitat issue. And we've all been involved, that is the scientists and analysts have all been involved in publishing papers on this dilemma, what do we do about monarch butterflies? And we published a paper called All Hands on Deck. And in that paper, the bottom line was that we have to replace something like 1.5 billion stems of milkweed due to the habitat loss that has occurred over the last 15 to 20 years. And that's an amazing amount of effort that has to be put into this to sustain this migration. 1.5 billion stems is an awful lot of milkweed to get in the ground.
And that's especially when people like to do, you know, weeding.
Yeah, well, people don't like milkweed. I mean, we got a lot of people who have an aversion to milkweed. So, you know, it's a big task that we're going to have to, if we're going to save this migration, we really have to bring things back.
You know, I'm curious how you keep from getting discouraged in the face of bad news about monarchs.
Yes, it's easy to get discouraged, but you know, what choice do we have? We either suck it up and get involved and try to do something positive, or we just give up. And I'm not ready to give up.
You're not ready to give up?
No, sir.
Well,
no, ma'am.
You make it sound very simple.
No, look, we've got to carry on, right? I mean, you want the world to be the way it was or the way it could be, very promising in the future. And what that means is that you really have to buckle up and get all hands on deck to address the problem. You can't just sit there and moan and groan about it or complain about it. You really have to step up and do the job that needs to be done.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Orly Chip Taylor, director of the Monarch Watch. Everyone can make a difference, and we'll hear more about how to help save butterflies in a few minutes. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Orly Chip Taylor, the founder and director of Monarch Watch, where they've been studying the decline of monarch populations due to loss of habitat. But they have also been fighting that decline with an effort to bring back the butterflies. It involves not just scientists, but regular people, too. Hi again, Chip.
Hi there.
So tell me more about how you do involve just the mass citizenry of throughout the Americas in this project.
Well, if I had a good publicist, I could really do this, but you know, it's kind of a word of mouth sort of thing and what we can do with the internet. You know, we started a program called the Monarch Way Station Program in 2005. It started out very slowly because we didn't really have a large base to communicate with, and we didn't have a lot of resources at that time. We were really a struggling organization, not sure whether we were going to survive from one year to the next.
Because people just didn't have that awareness to be seeking out information, right?
And that's correct. And people weren't really aware of the problem. I mean, I was pretty much aware of the problem. I received an email from a farmer in Nebraska in 2004, and he outlined the problem pretty clearly to me. He said, I'm using these new farm products, I'm using these new crop lines, and the effect of this is to eliminate milkweed from my corn and soybean fields, and I'm seeing monarch butterflies go down. And I said, oh my goodness, this is going to happen all over the country, and the result is that monarch populations are going to go down, because we realized that the milkweeds, even though they were relatively few, were the most important in corn and soybean fields, were the most important habitat for monarch butterflies. So if anything changed in agriculture, I realized that things were really going to go haywire for the monarchs, and they did. And so we pushed the idea of creating monarch way stations, and that went slowly at first, but now we're up with about 21,500 registered monarch way stations. So we're moving along.
Yeah, I noticed them with the signs announcing them all over the place now.
Right. Yeah, we have quite a few in the Kansas City area, and we have a very active group in the Kansas City area that's supporting monarch conservation, and we're very much appreciative of that and all of the efforts here. This is a stronghold for some of our program. We have a lot of people who tag monarch butterflies in this location and create habitats for monarch butterflies. Here in St. Louis are the two places in Missouri where we have a lot of involvement and activity. We would like to reach a lot more people, especially in the rural areas of both Kansas and Missouri. But generally, you know, we really appeal to the people in suburban and urban areas, and we really need to reach out a little bit more effectively to the people in all the rural areas to get them to create habitat for butterflies as well.
I was looking at some of what you've learned over the past 20 years of your involvement in butterfly research, and particularly monarch conservation, and it seems like you've observed a difference between the health of the monarch population returning from the Northeast and the health of the monarch population, or the size of the population returning from the Northwest, which I find interesting.
Yeah, so we're in the process of evaluating and analyzing something like 1.3, almost 1.4 million tagging records over the last 18 years, and we've got two more years to add to that. What those data are showing us is that there's a remarkable difference in the probability of getting to Mexico depending upon where it is that you were born as a monarch butterfly. And that is really quite surprising. And some of the reasons for the differences are not altogether clear. So a lot of research is still going to have to be done to find out why from the Northeast the butterflies aren't as successful as they are from the Midwest at getting to Mexico.
So the butterflies lay their eggs on their way north? At what point on the journey are the eggs laid?
Well, you've had a number of generations here. So you've got the butterflies that overwinter in Mexico. You know, this migration that's going on right now, these butterflies go down to central Mexico. They will overwinter about four and a half months, and then they begin coming back. And they come into Texas in the first week of March, and then they start reproducing in Texas and perhaps Oklahoma. And by the 1st of May, all of those butterflies are dead, but their offspring are still alive and ready to move north in May and early June. And so that first generation that's born in Texas and Oklahoma moves north into the northern breeding areas. And then you get one to two more generations, and then the migration starts over again.
You know, we've talked about the butterflies having this coordinated effort to kind of do this beautiful migration. But what about the people working to bring back the monarchs? I mean, do they feel like a community, a network, an international, I don't know, phenomenon?
Well, I hope they do. I mean, this is what it's going to take. It's going to take a massive effort to keep this population going, to keep this migration going. We're going to have people involved. And we've got a lot of people involved. On our mailing list, we have something like 40 or 50,000 emails. And we have a Facebook page, which is up at roughly the same number. And there are Facebook pages all over the country dealing with monarch butterflies. So there's a lot of engagement.
What inspires all these people?
You know, one of the interesting things is that monarch butterflies inspire passion. We were talking about that the other night, and saying, you know, Do people have passion for a grasshopper? Do they have passion for a cockroach? Do they have passion for this or that or the other thing? No, but they do have passion for monarch butterflies.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, as promised, how to make your own monarch habitat, the way station, as it's known, with Orly Chip Taylor, director of the Monarch Watch. Hi again, Chip.
Hey, Gina.
So you tell me this is not complicated.
No, it's not complicated.
People, they always say that.
But people should not feel that this is a difficult or impossible task. It's relatively easy to take your existing garden and introduce various species of milkweed into that garden. Monarchs need milkweed. The caterpillars only feed on milkweed plants, but the adult butterflies need nectar plants. So in addition to providing the host plants for the larvae, you also need to apply the knowledge of how to put a few plants in the ground to creating some nectar plants that will feed the adult butterflies. They need the nectar for the energy for flight and for reproduction. So the difficulty here is identifying the nectar plants. Milkweeds can be found online, can be found at nurseries. You can go to our website and look at the directions that we have for creating a monarch way station, and it's pretty simple. But nectar plants are often a little deceptive because a lot of the big box stores don't have nectar plants. They have.
Can you define nectar plant a little more?
That's where I was going.
Okay.
All right. So a nectar plant is a plant that the butterflies will visit to obtain nectar. And many of the plants that are sold in our nurseries really don't have any nectar.
So why not?
Well, because they're selected to be pretty. And they're selected not necessarily to produce pollen or nectar. So the vast majority of plants that you will find in your big box stores don't have nectar. So you have to.
I've never seen an ugly flower.
Well, yeah, that's the point. They're not ugly, but they're not necessarily beneficial to the insects, all right? So for pollinators, for monarch butterflies, you want things that produce nectar and you want things that produce pollen. Zinnias are good. Echinaceas are good. You know, butterfly bushes, which you're talking about, are good in this part of the country. Butterfly bushes are not so good along the coast, but they're really good here. But you've got a whole series of plants that are really co-evolved with butterflies, co-evolved with bees of various kinds. And those are the plants that you want to put in your garden. And there's a lot of lists of those that you can find on our website and other websites.
Do you have a favorite?
Oh, dear. Yeah, there are lots of favorites. I mean, there's a plant that's coming into bloom right now, which is called a Tartarian aster, which is an absolute monarch magnet. And then there's a...
what does it look like?
It's a rather tall aster. It's a blue aster with multiple flowers and fairly large flowers. And it just brings in the butterflies like crazy. And then there are lots of others. I mean, zinnias are good. You know, zinnias are an easy thing to grow. They produce a lot of nectar. Echinaceas that are very good for this type of thing. There's various other genera. Some of the mints are really good. We have a native mint, which is called pitcher sage, which is a very good nectar plant. As I was driving out of my driveway yesterday, I passed a pitcher sage, and there was a monarch sitting on it. You know, the butterflies will tell you what's got nectar in it.
You know, so you need to plant a nectar plant and milkweed. And milkweed, it's called that because people think of that as a weed and therefore think of that usually as undesirable. Has that been an uphill climb for you to talk people into it?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the idea that it's a weed, somebody was saying, we ought to call it the milk flower or something of the sort. But by the way, it's called milkweed because if you cut the stem or the flowers, the sap is milky. It's actually got latex in it. A high school teacher actually took the milkweed and worked with his students, and they actually created rubber.
Whoa. This is useful on many levels, I guess.
Well, milkweed was useful in the Second World War. They had high school students and Boy Scouts collecting milkweed seed pods because they were using the fluff from the seed pods for Mae West vests for Air Force people. And, you know, these milkweed saved a lot of lives in the Second World War.
So a Monarch Way station is just planting milkweed for caterpillars and nectar plants for butterflies. There is another, like, how-to that I'm sort of curious about. Unlikely to do this in our own yards, but this whole business of tagging a monarch. I think of a butterfly, a fragile, delicate creature with these beautiful wings that, and they're sort of fluttering unpredictably. How do you tag them?
Well, first of all, you first of all, Gina, you have to catch them. All right. So we inspire people to try to get nets to go out and catch the butterflies. We teach them how to take the butterfly out of the net without damaging the butterfly, how to hold it properly, and then how to apply the tag. And the tag is applied on the underside of the hind wing. Usually in the middle of the hind wing and of something we call a discal cell. And the tags are all coded. So every butterfly has an individual code.
But wait, so, I'm still kind of hung up on the physical tagging of a butterfly. You catch it in a net, but then still, how do you not hurt the butterfly?
You know, these are very, very tough butterflies.
Really? And
yes, they're very tough. They're very rubbery.
They don't look it.
They're very rubbery, and they have to be rubbery in order to get to Mexico, right? There's a long life ahead, and so they have to be fairly resilient. But you have to be smart about this. You hold them by the leading edge of the forewings, or you hold them where your fingers, thumb and forefinger, hold the legs together on the thorax. And the butterfly is immobilized under those conditions and can't move and can't flutter in your hand. And it's perfectly immobile. You're not hurting it. And then you can apply the tag. The tag looks like a little price tag that you might find on the bottom of a teacup that says made in China. In fact, I got an email from one woman who found a dead monarch butterfly in her driveway. And she said, oh, that's so beautiful. And she picked it up, turned it over, and saw the tag, and she said, oh, my gosh, it made in China.
Whoa.
But, of course, it wasn't made in China. It was one of our tags. But anyway, that was the first thing that came to mind because the tag is similar to those little price tags.
So when people see those tags, that does kind of alert them that there's something they could do. Like this woman found a dead butterfly, and that probably would have been the end of it if not for this tag, right? You wouldn't have gotten an email under those circumstances.
That's correct. And the note I got the other day was that we've had over 565 domestic recoveries so far this year. That is people either finding or seeing a tagged butterfly somewhere.
So While people were asking for donations to public radio, you were handing me a wax bag with a couple of monarchs in it. And I did not realize for a few seconds that they're alive. You brought living monarchs to the studio.
I did.
And wiggling.
Yes. And what I'd like to do is teach you how to hold one.
I'd like to learn.
All right. So as I told you, there are two ways to grip the butterfly so you're not going to hurt it and it's immobile. One is to hold it by the leading edge of the forewings right behind the head.
Okay, I'm trying to see around our microphones.
All right.
Okay, I'm watching carefully.
Right here behind the head, hold the two wings together, or actually you're holding all four wings together. Or you see all those little spots, those white spots on the thorax?
I do.
All right. Then you put your thumb and forefinger on those spots and hold it firmly.
That seems scarier because it looks like you're squishing its head. I know you're not. I trust you, but I don't trust me.
Gina, you can do this. Come on, Gina.
Okay. I do the first thing
thumb
you
and
did?
Thumb and forefinger on the leading edge of the forewings. Come on. We get kids to do this. You can do it.
Yeah. You know, okay, I'm holding a butterfly right now. And what is amazing to me about this, those lines that go between sort of the orange and brown tissue-y parts, those darker lines that carve out those shapes, you know, the outlines, I guess, if you were trying to describe it in artistic terms or something.
They're veins.
Yeah, and you can feel they're like wiry.
Yeah, that's right.
I hadn't imagined a textural difference and that part of the wing.
All right. Now the test is, can you move it to the other hand and put your thumb and forefinger where the spots are on the thorax and hold it firmly?
That's scary.
Oh, hold it firmly. Come
okay,
on.
Right there?
No, on the thorax, which is where the legs are, where all those spots are.
Here?
Right behind the head.
Here?
You can do it. Gina,
right
you can
there?
Do it. Yeah, right there. You got it. All right.
Oh.
So what I do,
it's
what
a little I, bit hairy.
What I do with groups is
I
that
feel it, like all the little the little bristly hairs kind of like wiggling under there.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah,
but you got it.
No,
you got it, and you're not hurting the butterfly.
You promise?
Yes, you're not hurting the butterfly. You're holding it firmly. Now you can pass it over to me.
Okay.
All right. I'll take it by the leading edge of the forewings.
I can't keep it.
And I can put it back in the envelope. And
what a thrill.
Yeah, but, you know, we get people to do this all the time. And when I have a little group, I get the group to pass the butterflies around from one to the next after I teach them how to do this. And once everybody's confident in how to do this, it makes it easier to tag the butterflies.
You know, I mean, this might sound like a silly question, but what I just did now, combined with, like, this weekend, I was at one of the monarch celebration events, and I looked inside a jar at a caterpillar and a larva and a cocoon, and I remember these terms from, you know, grade school, if not from the very hungry caterpillar. And I've seen illustrations, but really, like, looking inside a jar and seeing these stages of the butterfly life cycle again, it did make me feel like a kid, much like holding that butterfly just did. It's just this very, like, whoa kind of feeling. Do you still get that feeling?
Well, you know, one of the things that's so good about our program and the feedback that we get is that people say monarchs connect them with nature. They can connect with monarchs. They can raise the caterpillars. They can admire the chrysalis. They can marvel at the emergence of the butterfly. They can hold the butterfly. They can tag the butterfly. They can connect with the butterfly. They can connect with the biology, the migration, the wonder of it all. I mean, that's what really intrigues people. There's an intriguing connection here because it's accessible. How many things like this are accessible? You
don't need a microscope.
Well, yeah, and all the mammals that you know and the birds that you know, they're not as accessible, right? You can't touch them or feel them or raise them or watch them in the way that you can with this particular type of wildlife. Even other butterflies are not as accessible as this one is. And that's part of the magic of it. And that's part of what leads to the passion about it.
You know, I mean, the other pollinator you have been known for studying, you mentioned the bees and specifically the quote-unquote killer bees, I am guessing that didn't have the same kind of accessibility.
Well, it came with a few stings for sure. But I still, you know, as a biologist, the wonder of it made it fascinating. You know, and that's the other thing. I mean, the unknowns, the challenges of the unknowns of all of these organisms, you know, for a scientific point of view. So here's an unknown here. I'm going to pass this to you. This is a little cup, and it contains monarch chrysalises.
Remind us what the chrysalis is.
This chrysalis is that third stage of development. So you have the egg, you have the larva, you have the chrysalis, and it's through the chrysalis that you get the development to the adult stage. And what I've just handed you is a little container that contains the typical chrysalis, which is green. And then I've handed you some that are yellow or cream or pearl colored.
Yeah, they're very pastel.
Yeah, right. And that is fascinating because that's a mutation. And it's never been found in the wild. And that's something that we can bring into the lab and we can do some very interesting genetics with something like that. So, you know, as a biologist, there's opportunity in some of the things that people are not necessarily aware of. You know, which keeps us going. I mean, it's the ideas and unknowns that keep you going.
Chip Taylor, our time is up. Founder and director of Monarch Watch and professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at KU. Thank you for your time, for your demonstrations. This has been so much fun.
Hey, Gina.
And inspiring.
I've even got a donation.
Oh, my gosh. I'm honored. And the station thanks you. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Today's show was produced by Suzanne Hogan, Melody Rowell, and Coy Duggar. I'm Gina Kaufman. Keep showing your support for our membership drive, and I will catch you tomorrow.